Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're getting semantic to understand the deeper meaning behind some of the foods we love. First, we'll look at the big debate happening around the word milk.
Who the hell are you to tell me what is the name of my product and my landscape and everything we've cared about when, you know, you don't have anything invested in except to put out a little money to buy it? It's our entire life.
Then we get the lowdown on the language of cider.
So the first thing that's really confusing about dryness is that it has nothing to do with how something actually feels in your mouth.
And finally, we get our fill of tiki talk.
You don't walk into a tiki bar and be like, oh yeah, this is what Polynesia is probably like. Like, it's supposed to be like fantasy and stuff. That's the hard part. It's so easy to do tiki bad, and that's where it gets a bad name.
Tune into this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. By some historical accounts, sushi was being served at restaurants in the United States in the early 1900s, with the first sushi restaurant opening in the U.S. in 1906 in Los Angeles. But anti-Japanese sentiments and restrictions on immigration led to a sharp decline in the acceptance of Japanese culture and cuisine in America. It wasn't until nearly 60 years later, when in 1966 in Los Angeles, a Japanese businessman named Noritoshi Kanai opened a nigiri sushi bar inside a Japanese restaurant called Kawafuku in LA's Little Tokyo, when sushi began to make a strong comeback. Later on in the 1970s, Ken Susa of Kimjo in Los Angeles invented the California roll, and by the 80s and 90s, sushi restaurants could again be found in much of America, with over 4,000 sushi restaurants now open in the United States. But the vast majority of those sushi restaurants of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and still today, are a la carte, where you can mostly order hand rolls, and it's fairly inexpensive. But sushi has also generated millions of food-obsessed fans on the higher price point end of the dining spectrum. People that are searching for new chef counter experiences, which can be called omakase or kaiseki, that can cost well over $100 or $200 per person. Today we'll be talking with Chef Nick Kim. He's a partner and the co-chef of Shuko in the East Village, and they only serve omakase and kaiseki menus. Shuko, which Chef Kim operates with his partner and co-chef Jimmy Lau, received 3 stars and was a critic's pick from Pete Wells in the New York Times. Both men are alums of Masa, and they worked together at Netta prior to opening an incarnation of Shuko in the Hamptons and then opening their brick-and-mortar location. Chef, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So on this program, we always start way at the beginning. We start in the childhood. I want to talk about Los Angeles. You were born there?
Yes, and raised.
And your parents are first generation. They came over from Korea?
Yes.
And so where did you live in LA, and what was the experience like having first generation parents and you being a first generation American born kid?
Grew up in San Fernando Valley, but raised in Los Angeles over the hill. Growing up was pretty unique because our neighborhoods was just multicultural. It wasn't predominantly Korean. It was just like similar to New York, just all walks of life. It was a great way to grow up for sure.
And were your parents, did they move here specifically for a job or a career, or were they seeking out just a better life and then they made their way in a new career once they came?
I think all of the above. Mm-hmm. My mother was a hairstylist then and still now, and her career really didn't change. My father's a businessman. He exports and imports products. And so coming to America, it was sort of, he adopted that system here, but my mother's career was similar.
And what was your childhood home like? Were you rebelling against, the Korean culture that your parents had brought here?
Absolutely.
Were you like, I want to be an American kid. I want to go to the mall and skateboard. I mean, like, what did you do as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. All of the above. Mm-hmm. Again, growing up in L.A., skateboarding was big. Small but big in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So grew up exactly what you could picture a kid from L.A. would do when you're young.
Getting into trouble, skating in pools, or
right? I was more ramp, so I did a lot of ramps and pools. Uh-huh. Street skating at that time was still not as big as it is now, but a lot of neighborhood kids. We would just put our money together somehow and build ramps and create chaos, but then be home by 5 p.m.
And was it a strict household? Like, did you do a lot of family dinners? Was that a big part of your culture?
Dinner was definitely a big part of it. Like, it wouldn't start until my dad would be home, and everything would be shut down while we're having dinner. we wouldn't answer phone calls, or when my father did, it would be very brief. But yes, dinner was very, every lunch, dinner, breakfast, anytime there was eating involved, it was very important.
And who did the cooking?
Growing up, a lot of was my mother and my grandmother. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate to be grew up and raised by my grandmother. And anyone that has grandmas, they know how special they are.
And so did you spend any time cooking alongside them? Did you get into Korean food when you were younger?
No. I think growing up Korean in a Korean household, you don't really realize it, but food is a big part of your life. And as a child, as an adult, it's just a very big part of Korean culture for sure.
And do I have this correctly that you did travel to Japan before with your mom when you were younger, and then you were intrigued by Japan at a young age?
Something like that, yes. My mother was a hairstylist for Vidal Sassoon back then, and so she traveled a lot to Japan and overseas. So, and at times we would go and still have family. Like, my uncle, her brother, lives in Tokyo. And so growing up, definitely Japan was part of our livelihood.
Do you remember any specific times when you were young and you went to Japan, maybe first experiences with Japanese food? Or like, I don't know what Japanese food was like in LA at that time, but was it really common that your family would go out and eat Japanese food in LA? Or was it like you went to Japan and it was the first time that you would experience that mm-hmm. type of cuisine?
Japanese food in LA, as far as our family, when we went out, was very average, very normal. You know, mm-hmm. the teriyaki chickens and stuff like that, and the California rolls. There was nothing spectacular. It could have been, but I was just too young to understand, maybe.
Uh-huh.
And I remember going to Japan and seeing beef bowl, Yoshinoya, which is kind of big in LA. And then I remember that was one of the first connection. I'm like, wow, this is this is cool how there's beef bowl in LA and there's one in Japan. And I realized that there was of course it's Japanese, but I finally remember making the connection.
And when you come back to the United States, you enter your teenage years and you score the most luxurious, traditional, glamorous job of all. You start as a dishwasher at a restaurant.
Yes.
One of the best ways to get entry into a restaurant, because you get to watch and maybe you rise. So what was your experience like getting that first job at sort of the bottom of the totem pole?
Right. I was actually underneath the dishwasher. So I was like the dishwasher assistant.
Uh-huh.
Just in the way a lot. Just, you know, being a teenager and just wanted to belong, but wasn't sure how I belonged to the restaurant. I just knew that around this chaos that I kind of enjoyed it. It kind of reminded me of skateboarding during working at a restaurant for a child or a teenager. It was just sort of free and organized chaos. And that sort of, I remember, intrigued me.
And you know, it's kind of like a big jump to have a teenage job that it looks interesting, it's intriguing, to really make the next jump, which is that you decided to go to culinary school. And what interests me a lot about the point in chefs' lives is when, at a very young age, you make a decision to do something very concretely about it. Some people fall backwards in it, mm-hmm. but making the decision to go to culinary school is really diving all the way in. First, how did you come to that decision? And second, what did your family feel about what maybe at that time wasn't a super traditional job career choice?
I think especially being Korean and raised in a Korean household, I remember mentioning to my dad, he was actually confused. He was like, I don't understand. And my mother was a little bit, because she's sort of an artist, she kind of understood where I was coming from. And it wasn't about just the restaurant. She just wanted me to just try things and just sort of seek things out. So I know she sort of supported me. My father was a little bit different.
There was sort of a bit of a pressure to maybe go to a traditional 4-year college and get a degree, maybe?
Absolutely. I went to college for freshman semester, and I remember just not really focused in school, but really thinking about work. And I remember thinking, like, why am I, like, not focusing at school, which I paid for, versus, like, washing dishes, you know, and putting the plates away. And I remember I wanted to tap into that thought, why am I so torn? And and I think the more hours I spent in the restaurant, the more I realized at an early age that this is sort of what I wanted to do. But without, you know, obviously a teenage sort of thinking, and that's sometimes very powerful because, you know, you think you know what you're saying, but you really don't.
Yeah.
I just was lucky and fortunate for sure.
Were you pretty focused at culinary school, or did you kind of mess around and not get serious till later?
Well, the first time I ever left home, LA, I moved to San Francisco. So I was by myself for the first time. So I had to be serious. Mm-hmm. I had no other choice because I realized when I moved first time out of my home that if I leave something there, it doesn't get picked up. My grandma's not going to pick it up and fold it or wash it. And move to Tenderloin, San Francisco is it's a wake up call. You know, it's not Beverly Hills. You know, it's a very real grown up, you know, neighborhood. So I woke up and grew up really fast in San Francisco for sure.
Started to fend for yourself a little bit.
Yep, definitely. And I think I even worked harder back then too, because I was going to school. I was working morning and nights and just really focused. Just trying to keep afloat, I remember.
So were you going to school and also working in a restaurant?
Right.
Oh, okay.
And I remember, you know, really just going back to your questions, I was really sort of focused as a young age because I was not that good. I think if I was better, maybe I would maybe not put so much pressure and thinking that I have to work so much. But I just wanted to get better. So I just really had that in my head.
And what made you feel like you weren't good? Because a lot of teenagers, speaking from experience and also just knowing what my friends were like back then, you can often have this mindset of invincibility. Mm-hmm. Like, I know everything and I am going to succeed. What made you kind of the opposite of that? What made you think like you needed to really grind so hard because you weren't good yet?
I think like growing up, like skateboarding or playing basketball or just doing things and knowing that, okay, I could be better at this or somebody else is better. And you know that even playing basketball, if you're missing shots, you're like, okay, why am I missing these shots? You know, so I think I was my own, you know, worst sort of critic too, which also helps to sort of, I remember when I was younger, while everybody was sort of enjoying their weekends, I wanted to sort of spend more time in the kitchen, you know, just put those hours in and see why and how I could get better.
And at that point, did you see a future for yourself in fine dining? Did that seem like the direction you wanted to go in?
Oh, absolutely. But at that time, it seemed so far away because I was so not good. You know, I was struggling just to keep, you know, the simple things going, you know, and turns out those are all natural things. You know, I wasn't born with the natural Michael Jordan gift, so I had to sort of go through the regular procedures and just get better and stronger and be a more alert and, you know, all of the above.
Do you think that all that repetition somehow the immediate repetition of culinary school that translate later on to the precision of Japanese style of cooking? Or is that sort of like you went in a very sort of different route?
Well, I was My original training is classically French training, and so, but I think anyone that cooks, there's a secret, hidden, or not secret, very loud love for Japanese culture. Mm-hmm. I don't know one cook or chef that doesn't get it, you know. There's always that love for it, for sure.
And before you did get involved in Japanese cuisine, you moved to Hawaii and you kind of got a crash course in what a French kitchen experience could be like, right?
Right. In San Francisco, I met Chef Ian, and he was coming from France for he was working at Alain Pressard in France, and he was scouted to come to Hawaii to open a restaurant. And he stopped in San Francisco to help a friend out where I was working at, and he saw that I was sort of struggling, so he approached me and said, you know, when you're ready to sort of take the time to learn, you know, come to Hawaii and, you know, I'll show you the mechanics. And that's exactly what I did.
And so how much time did you spend there? And was that a true French-style kitchen? Like, was it the intensity that we expect from
Absolutely.
That?
Yeah, because Chef Yang came, and he came with a brigade of French chefs from France, so me and like one server were the only non-French person in the restaurant, which was pretty cool and pretty like exciting because it just sped up the knowledge and exposure and the intensity for sure.
And that was your really kind of first true cooking
Absolutely.
Job out
right.
of culinary school.
Yes, because they were like, this, you turn the knob to the right and the fire will come. You know, this thing is called a sheet pan. You know, there was all these lingos and things that you did in a restaurant, which I was trying to mimic in San Francisco, just role-playing, just pretending, but I was really trying to. But in Hawaii, it was like the real thing, and I was trying to put that in place.
Did you feel like you belonged, or that did you have imposter syndrome at first? Or neither?
I think I was sort of so like focused and so determined that I was sort of had this. There was a chef, Jacob, who's I'm a good friends of, and he's one of the chefs that came from France with Ian, and he's the one that sort of mentored me upwards. You know, he's the one that like washed my face, cleaned my fingernails, and okay, this is where we start. And he sort of, you know, gave me huge verbal lessons, you know, romantic lessons, cooking lessons. And I didn't even know that was all happening because it was just considered work. And there were nights where we get off and we spent 4 or 5 hours just talking about service and food. And till this day, we're still close like that. So he definitely made me feel not like out of place or anything like that.
Do you still generally bounce ideas off him? Like, do you call him and say like, hey, this thing happened in the restaurant, I wanted to run it by you? Does he work in the food industry still? Or
yes, he still does. He's the funny thing is that I look at him still as Chef Jacob, but he looks at me like now Chef Nick. So it's like this weird thing that we have now, because he's like, why are you asking me? I'm like, because your thoughts matter. You know, he's just it's like this reverse role.
In his eyes, you're an equal,
right?
But you never look at him that way,
right,
and you never will.
Never will, because for me, it's just that Chef Jacob, you know?
When you concluded your time in Hawaii, you decided that you were time for your next stop on your journey. You came back to Los Angeles.
Right.
And you were working again for a French chef.
Right. This time, by spending time with all the French chefs and realizing what they do in order to move on to the next restaurant and learn from other chefs, is to scout the chefs. And that's sort of what I was doing for a year. Like, which chef should I want to work for or go for and all this? And Chef Ludovic, who was the chef at L'Orangerie then, who's the chef at Trois Mecs now in L.A., was coming to L.A. He was 24, you know, just coming with power, energy, and just at that time, like really avant-garde food. So, you know, I wrote letters and, you know, back then there was no emails or anything like that. So I just wrote letters, no responses and stuff. And then there was a point in Hawaii where the chef knew that I wanted to kind of move on and learn other things. And the chef helped me write this letter and contact Ludovic, and in return he replied. And
so when you say, you know, avant-garde cuisine, it was rooted in French technique and French flavor. But if you can remember, what were some of the things that were happening at that restaurant which made it different than a traditional French brasserie or even a fine dining French restaurant?
Right. So, like, this will be my second restaurant going to L'Orangerie. So anything that was remotely colorful or just something eventful was like, wow, to me. Mm-hmm. So when we were doing like these untraditional inside out terrines, that for me was like, whoa, you know. And it took like 8 hours, 2 days each day. And the manpower, the hours that people were putting into to create something was sort of the avant-garde for me. Usually in Hawaii, you know, some of the prep didn't take so long. It was just like cut, put together. And at L'Orangerie, there was an actual procedure on how to create things, not just cut or put it together. And that was sort of avant-garde for me, that it just took like four people to put something together as well.
Was that a young kitchen? He was very young.
Right.
You were young. Were there kind of older guys that anyone was leaning on or whispering like, hey, I got a question? Or was it just really a bunch of young guys kind of doing something new and out of the norm?
It was, you know, looking back now, yes, the oldest guy was the owner, Mr. Ferry, and everybody, the kitchen was all young. Again, it was all French besides me and Angel, who was in the meat station. He was sort of there forever, and he was, till this day, one of the amazing cooks I've ever seen. And yes, it was just all young chefs. So, you know, there was a lot of good energy, a lot of creativity at the time, too. You know, back then, we would have about up to like 20, 30 sauces that weren't held by any, you know, additives. So those were sort of the challenges as well, how to keep the sauces from not breaking. Mm-hmm. How do you sear the perfect langoustine 50 times a day, you know, hit it at a perfect degree without no cryovac machines and stuff like that. So
it was just a huge learning curve. You were doing things that you had never done before.
Right. It was like going from community college with no disrespect, and then going to Harvard. You know, it was just like the kitchen was beautiful. You know, it was all custom made. Everybody had their own station, and it was all a true brigade in every sense of it.
How did you enter into that kitchen? Did you enter in like on colds, or did you have a non-specific role and then you rised up the ranks? Like, how did they, as being a non-French person entering again, mm-hmm. a French kitchen, did you have to fight your way for respect?
No, not much fighting. Everybody was pretty cool. Everybody was young. So there was a lot of like laughters and like jokes being played. Like mm-hmm. When I walked in, all my station, there would be nothing but like soy sauces and sesame oil, but it was all for fun. It wasn't like any malicious or anything weird. Mm-hmm. Everybody was like, at the end of the day, like we all hung out with each other too at the end of the day, because these French cooks, they didn't know really LA. So it was like, it was off the court, on the court was all like kind of a good team. Mm-hmm. And all we did was talk about food. And that was the funny thing, which is like a bunch of nerds never talking about girls or something that really matters, but like come off like a 12-hour shift and talk about food for the next 4 hours, and then it's 5 a.m. and we'll do it all over again.
That's how you can consolidate 10,000 hours of learning into a couple years. You never turn it off. The switch is always
on. And we were working 6 days a week, and on one day's off, we were also hanging out. So it was like this
probably trying a new restaurant, right?
Well, and we actually, every other day off, which was I think Sunday or Monday at that time, we would actually go to our friends or girlfriend's house or someone's house that was available at the kitchen, and then everyone would kind of create a little baby dish outside of, you know, and you know, we're drinking, having fun, but we're actually the day off was meant for each person to create something outside of the restaurant.
So it really never stopped.
It never stopped.
It was like an R&D potluck day.
Right.
It was really
like Harvard, like just on like all, like I just remember even days off going to bookstores and just looking at books if I'm not hanging out with them. It was just constant.
It sounds pretty magical. It sounds like everyone was all in together.
Right.
And you just are pushing each other upwards, right? It's like plates, tectonic plates rubbing against each other. It's just there's no other direction to go except learning and moving forward.
And I remember at that time, there wasn't not many new people coming in because the team was so tight and it wasn't this like turnover thing. People were committed, you know, and, you know, did we have bad days? Of course, just like any real life situation, but it really was, felt like a genuine team and everybody really wanted the restaurant to do well.
We're going to take a quick break here on the line. And when we come back, we're going to start talking about Masa. And then, of course, your move to New York and your projects as well. Stick with us here on the line on Heritage Radio. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Serchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Damon Bolte.
And I'm Souther Teague.
Together, we host The Speakeasy, a show where we discuss cocktails, spirits, wine, beer, tea, coffee, and all things in the liquid universe.
Yeah, our guests range from bartenders and brewers, alchemists and ambassadors, roasters and regulars, hippies and homebrewers, and every expert enthusiast in between.
Browse episodes of The Speakeasy wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org. If I was, I don't remember. So what if I'm wrong? Sue me. That's
your girlfriend. Yeah, she know about me. I keep it on the low so you don't know about me. As a matter of fact... Welcome back to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. Today on the show, I'm joined by Chef Nick Kim. He is one of the partners in Shuko, which is located in Manhattan. And before the break, we were talking a lot about Los Angeles and you coming up in the food world. Something dramatic happened when you read about Masa, and you just, what clicked in you that you said, I want to be involved in that?
Right. Going back to L.A. again, L'Orangerie, there was this myth about this Japanese man having a small little restaurant and he's charging $500 serving blowfish and just like, if anyone's cooking at that time, early or late 90s, about 2000, we didn't hang out with, you know, wealthy people, so we were sort of disconnected to this urban legend.
Mm-hmm.
And fast forward... Chef Ludovic, eventually, when I left L'Orangerie, he had sent me to France to continue my training and getting some more exposure. And while in France, my ex-girlfriend at the time would save me LA Times restaurant reviews and save like a month of it and send it all out. And then one of the deliveries had Masa in it. And he actually was in an article. Like for the first time ever.
He was real.
He was real. We knew he was real, but we were like, God, is this like not real? Because like nobody we know knows, but obviously we don't hang out with wealthy people.
Yeah.
So, and he was reviewed, got the, you know, the highest stars and all this. And I'm like, wow, this guy does exist, you know? And I did this classic thing again and thought about what I want to do. And throughout these years, I'm like, why is this Japanese thing all in our heads? You know, when we're talking with cooks, we're all pretending to, like we're just teriyaki sauce and, you know, like just the amateur Japanese ingredients. But nonetheless, this Japanese love affair was always around. And when I finally read that article, did the classic thing, wrote the letter, no response. And then, you know, after a couple months later, I was like, you know what? I'm going to just leave and come back to LA and just knock on this man's door.
And what do you think that it is about Japanese cuisine that makes it really respected as a true art form?
Because I think going exactly what you're saying, it is art in sort of Japanese food culture. It's sort of, yes, it's to consume, to live, but as a cook, when you create, it's really an art. Well, a lot of times when I'm cutting, I'm not cutting to produce quantities of sales or for customers. It's really like cutting for a purpose of how do I cut this the best way, even though I cut it a billion times. Like every cut, every time I'm making sushi or every time I'm assembling something, it's like per plate, per sushi, per item. And for me, those are like very art, comes from an artistic point of view.
Sometimes it feels almost, from the outside perspective, it can feel almost like a show. It's less about eating and it's more about a performance, and the technique almost leads flavor.
Right. No, absolutely. Because, you know, you and I could have the same tuna and I could just cut it all crazy and you cut it all beautiful. And my tuna is not going to be as tasty as yours.
Mm-hmm. And so you're intrigued by what's happening at Masa. You go and knock on the door. He's charging exorbitant prices for tasting omakase style menus. You go there. What happens? Do you get the job?
No. You know, being young again and like not really thinking things through, I go there straight from LAX and with my luggage. And
I'm ready. I have my knives.
Right,
I'm ready to
right.
go.
I haven't really told my mom and my family, my sisters and everybody that I moved back to LA quite yet. So because I wanted to stop at the restaurant to see if I even got a job first. And immediately I knew that it wasn't going well because it lasted like 30 seconds. And, you know, he gave me the goodbye forever bow, you know, not see you later bow, but like don't come around bow. And just went home with, you know, my tail between my legs. But my family was happy. They were like, oh, you're back. You know, I'm like, yeah, but I'm. You said,
by the way, I came home for a job and I didn't get
right,
it.
Right, right.
And so how did you end up in the Masa family? Because obviously we fast forward and you end up working there and you end up moving to New York. So
right.
You earned his trust and respect somehow. How did you get your foot in the door and how did you rise at Masa?
I literally put my foot in the door. Like I literally did that because I came like my plan was, okay, let's just go once a month and see what he does or something. And then, you know, I did that for like a couple of months and it just got more annoying to him. And I just recall the last time, I think he just sort of felt bad and he was just like, okay, just come back tomorrow. Leave all your silly knives at home. Just come. And, you know, I just cleaned for a while. And now I'm the best cleaner ever of anything. 'Cause that's what I did, you know. And for me, that was like silly in the beginning, but it made so much sense at the end of the day. When I started to get it, I'm like, oh, wow, okay. That's why he had me clean and sanding things and, you know, because the whole time it's like, oh, I just want to get down. I want to cut something or do something. And he was just like, no.
Because there's so much more to it than that.
Right. He put me in a real, like, sort of apprentice. You know, he's like, you really want to do this? Okay. And then so he started me from the bottom, which, you know, I was happy to do. But, you know, I saw the other guys, and the other guys meaning one other guy. There was only like four staff.
Yeah.
Doing things. And I'm like, I just want to, you know, just jump in there too. But he just would be like, get the plate, wash the dishes, put it away, and like things like that. And all it started to click, you know, like a year later while like eating or showering, I'm like, oh, that's why he had me do that, because it all just started to make sense.
There's more to mise en place than just what goes in the nine pan.
Absolutely.
Right?
Right.
It starts way before that and
right.
It ends way after
right.
that. And even though the focus is obviously what goes on the plate, because that's what goes to the diner,
mm-hmm.
There's 100 other things that are at play there.
Right. Because Masa's like, when he thinks about like just not like about the food, he's also thinking about the ceramics. So when he had me pull out ceramics and put it back, he was actually showing me like why he's using those particular ceramic for this particular time for this particular person, but without saying it. So once we hit a season, I saw the same guest, I would pull the same ceramic. So it started to like kick in like, oh, he's like, oh, okay. It only took a year, but okay, here we are.
And you end up getting to touch some fish at Masa.
Right.
And then you spend time there. And what year did you end up moving to New York?
We moved to New York the first visit was around 2002 because mm-hmm. he was like, we're moving to New York. Go see New York, see if you like it. You know, like, I know I'm asking you, but you don't really have a choice. for me, it was like the most exciting thing. You know, I'm like, sure, you know, I'm totally. And the reason why I even got to touch the fish, because he's like, we're moving to New York. I need you to start doing things, not just pulling plates and cleaning the sink 100 times.
And a lot of important things happen at Masa in New York. First, you meet who becomes your partner,
yes,
right? And
right,
also,
exactly.
Masa just becomes a massively dominant force in the New York food scene. And then internationally speaking, it garners accolades that I assume bring in people, like you said, like you didn't have contact with those people when you were younger. Now, the only people you're seeing come into Masa are like millionaires that travel around the world and seek out these dining experiences. Like once you get 3 Michelin stars, what changes?
I think at Masa, what I noticed is that not much really changed. His intensity, his focus was always just sort of even keel. Like it was always at, if it's 1 through 10, it was always at 20.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether we did 2 covers or we had 0 star. Actually, a lot of the accolades, it wasn't really hung up with no disrespect. It just wasn't exposed. You know, not like no disrespect to other restaurants. That's just what he did. He didn't.
He knew it. He internalized it. And then he just kept doing what he was doing.
I think it was more about like he just really was in tune with just the food and the guests. He just wanted to get the best product, do the best thing he can do for the best, you know, for his guest. It wasn't really about anything much. And sometimes he has to charge a certain way because in order to produce, get those certain products and be able to put in a certain ceramic and XYZ, it's not cheap.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about your partnership with Jimmy. You guys meet at Masa. Obviously, you've had a great deal of success together and you've spent a long time in business together and working together. One of the hardest things about being in the restaurant business is finding good people and creating a working relationship, a friend relationship. Oh, we work on the line together. We go out and get drinks. You can have like a million of those. I'm curious, how do you complement each other? And how did you know that Jimmy would be a good partner?
I would be a liar if I said I knew. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we both just sort of gravitated to each other with, you know, sort of food being, you know, the catalyst for sure. The food sort of was the, just like all my friends, really, the food is really the bond.
Uh-huh.
And his theory, his thoughts were very similar to mine. And when we didn't agree, it still was okay. So that's when you know, or at least I knew that meant maybe that we should pursue this.
And so when you decide that you really want to open up your own place, you both have worked for other people. How does Shuko come to be? How do you find the space? And also, this is more long-winded, but how did you decide what you wanted Shuko to be? There's so many permutations of Japanese cuisine, omakase, kaiseki. How did you both drill down into what Shuko would come to be?
I think Shuko sort of was a very interesting personal sort of project. You know, at Shuko, we play a certain type of music. The volume's a little bit higher than normal. And that's sort of just a reflection of growing up in Los Angeles. I think in Los Angeles, music is just around us all the time. And so my sort of wanting when I had a restaurant was to have that sort of, I guess, feel. Because I think music is a big part of just everyday life.
And so when you were working together to kind of define what the restaurant would serve and how it would serve, were there like hours and hours of discussion about we're going to serve the food in this way, we're going to be traditional, we're going to be non-traditional, like sourcing all these things that might differentiate Shuko from, say, Masa or another omakase experience?
Right, absolutely. I think shout out to Adam Block. He was, you know, Adam and I spent many, many, many hours. He was the opening chef for us. And he also worked at Masa as well. So for, you know, when the opportunity came, we sort of saw eye to eye on what we thought would work here. you know, just looking at the menu now, like even the apple pie ice cream, you know, it's a very personal menu. It's a very personal restaurant, meaning right before Shuko, my little nephew was in New York, and we spent a lot of time, or he spent a lot of time eating apple pies. And so when he left, I was a little bummed, and it was sort of I wanted to do something that maybe reflected our summer and, you know, my nephew. And then I approached Adam. I'm like, let's do an apple pie, but like do it in a way we're not messing with the traditional apple pie. And Adam totally got it. The hard part was to make the perfect pie. That took months for sure.
And it's definitely not something that you would think would cap off a meal.
Absolutely.
At an omakase
restaurant. Right. Well, no one, I think 99.9%, nobody got it besides Adam. Yeah. Everybody, Jimmy, everybody was like, I don't know what you're saying. You know, everybody was worried. You know, and so was I, but I'm just like, you know what? I think this might work. And I did call Jacob about the apple pie too. And he thought it was a good idea.
I want to talk about the business side of things, because when it comes down to it, we talked about art earlier. It's a business. It has to produce money to stay open, unless it's just a vanity project. Right. But people have... the thought that at such a high price point, you must be making like huge margins. Mm. But there's something about cost of goods and dealing with seafood. And also you referenced like ceramics and how everything has a specific piece that goes with it. So can you talk a little bit about sourcing of your products and just in the New York competitive restaurant world, how do you operate a very small seat restaurant and make it work from a business perspective?
Right. It's very challenging to have a small, literally a small restaurant because, you know, just day-to-day, the operation, because literally the space is so small that it's sometimes we're working on top of each other. So we're actually very creative on how to maneuver around each other. And you know, we have tons of staff at all times in order to produce what we want Shuko to be. I think it looks a lot more intense because usually restaurants don't have an open kitchen and you don't really see all the staff because they're, you know, behind a wall. But at Shuko, the only walls are really the walls that's holding up the restaurant and walls downstairs. Otherwise, it's all open. We have one door that opens from the outside and inside, but otherwise there's really no more doors. So you actually see a lot of activity, and I think that's the cool part of it, about it. It might be a little intense to a lot of people.
How many people do you have working at Shuko?
Like 30.
And a 20-seat restaurant.
At a 20-seat restaurant. But it takes an army sometimes to just produce to get ready for service, and then another whole army to do service.
And so on a typical service, how many people are on the line visible to customers?
At the sushi side of it, the bar, the sushi bar, we have up to like 5 or 6, but our bar beverage program is back there too. So then you have like 2, a som and a beverage. And then we have about 3 servers at all times, and then like 3 or 4 guys in the kitchen. And the whole different team downstairs.
Prepping
and just doing other things, yes.
So it's, my next question was going to be, do you find it grueling to own your own restaurant? And do you have a system? And as a small business owner myself, I find that the amount of day-to-day things that pop up that I did not expect can often interfere with what you're hoping your plans were for that day. Do you and Jimmy feel like you have a great system now? You've been open for mm-hmm. several years. Do things still catch you off guard, or do you have sort of an even smooth flow now that you've been open for several years?
I think we have a really good system. I wouldn't say great. We're always striving for great. Even if we were great, I think we would always try to go for greater. I think we have a good system, and when there are curveballs, we have a team that can sort of adapt to any changes. But as you know, there's like 30 curveballs and a knuckleball that comes at you a day, mm-hmm. you know, and the days that you don't really have anything coming, you're like, wait, what happened today?
Is there a specific dish that's on the menu right now that you can describe that you feel is a really wonderful representation of what you do? Can you talk us through a little bit of what the prep and the plating process is like of that specific dish?
Yeah, definitely. We're in spring right now. So right now we're just sort of, I just got back from Japan. I spent a month in Japan in Kyushu Island. So I came back just sort of in love with this area of Japan. And so we have a fish purveyor out there as well in Kyushu Island, Fukuoka. So we're creating this one dish right now with pretty much 99.9% coming from that area, besides the king crab. It's a king crab dish, but everything in it is, even all the way from the sauces, is from Kyushu Island. And that I'm very excited about, because while I was there, I was trying to like think about this dish that I wanted to come back with, but representing my month there, mm-hmm. and this is sort of coming together right now.
And so, what are the components of it?
There's wakame, which is fresh seaweed. It's alive. It's pulled out of the water from the ocean, and so it's like a real live thing. It's breathing. It's alive, and it's from Kyushu Island as well. Umipudo, which is sea grapes, also coming from Kyushu Island. And then we have the aka uni that goes with it as well. And that's also from Kyushu Island. What else am I missing right there? I know. And then udo, which is also from Kyushu Island, which is like a vegetable.
And so obviously that comes as part of a sequential a meal of several dishes. The omakase that you have right now, are there great variations from day to day, and how many items are part of it? Or I guess how many plates hit the counter in a traditional omakase when people go to Shuko?
We have two menus. The one kaiseki, which is a combination of not sushi and sushi. And the omakase is like one sort of sunomono dish, which is like a right now, it's a trout with a ponzu dish, and then goes into the sushi. And the kaiseki is a combination of cooked, raw, and meat, tempuras, and then sushi.
Is there something that you have not achieved yet at Shuko that you think about all the time? Maybe it's an accolade, maybe it's something small, like there's a dish that you want to play around with that you haven't been able to get to. Curious, because you've been open for several years now, what is something that you are aspiring to do with Shuko?
I think the accolades are great, and I think they're an honor and feel really proud of it. But I know that I don't wake up in the morning or go to sleep thinking about it. I do really think about like the structure of the restaurant and the staff and the team and how we can do things better, how we can do things better for them, how could they could do better for us, and just like a team, how to always make the team be better, and how do we create a better environment, how do we have everybody just become more of a team. I find myself thinking more of that a lot, and also about dishes, but I spend a lot of time thinking, how do we make these people better, how do we move these things up.
From a team perspective, you have 30 people on staff, and one of the best ways to help retain talent is to grow it.
Right.
And I'm curious if you and Jimmy have plans to do anything, a different location, same concept, different concept, maybe a bigger Shuko, maybe a different city. It's just one of the best ways to turn your great staff into a great organization.
Absolutely.
Any plans for anything related to that?
Sure. It's always in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. You know, always looking for that next great space. You know, it's like trying to find that next great song. You know, in the near future, we're doing, in the summertime, we do a pop-up all summer long in the Hamptons. And, you know, some of the team members goes out there as well. But yeah, we're always sort of looking for the next great spot.
as you wake up every single day and you're thinking about all these different things and you're a business owner and you're balancing your time with Jimmy, what's a typical week look like for you, if there is one? Do you try to head into the restaurant 4, 5, 6 days a week? Like, how do you organize your time as a partner in the restaurant?
We're there 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. You know, we're open 7 days and you know, we do the traditional 5 days working, 2 days off. We still work the service. We're very still in it. Just going back to the team members, we're definitely trying to recognize the people that are doing really well. And so when that happens, we sort of try to put it more on them to kind of grow so that it doesn't always, the sun's not always shining on us, you know, let the sun shine on them a little bit, you know. And that's also sushi and kitchen, you know, even servers or prep guys, any staff member, any team member that is doing well, we definitely want to recognize that and put the shine on it for sure.
My last question is basically about specifically about competition and the New York City dining landscape, which is there are so many choices for people. Why do you think Shuko is special, and how do you make it a truly unique experience for a diner when they come in?
The restaurants in New York, first, I'm a fan. I'm a big sort of fan of all the restaurants in New York. I love my city. I love all the restaurants here. I wish I just had more time to go to all of them because, you know, I think New York is such a great city and we produce such great restaurants.
Why Shuko?
Why Shuko? I think Shuko is sort of unique because it's, again, going back to the personal thing, you know, when like my family came, they were not surprised. They were like, you're not fooling nobody. And I was kind of asking them, why would you say that? Because they were like, this is what you do in your bedroom when growing up, you know, just play the music, turn the lights down low and act like you're doing something, you know? So, you know, like good friends of mine, cousins or whatever, when they come in, they're like, wait a minute, you know, and some things taste like my grandma's, you know, not intentionally, but I think subconsciously, sometimes you do things like that, you know, and there's a lot of overtone for Jimmy too. You know, it's just not me, but there's things that comes from Jimmy's, you know, inner self as well and thoughts. And, but a lot of it is like even Richard Block, the designer, kind of helped me pull things out of my own thoughts, you know, which I think good designers do.
To let everyone know where they can go see you at Shuko. Tell everyone the address and the website, please, so that they can come and experience your and Jimmy's mind as you do every single night in the East Village.
It's the restaurant is Shuko Restaurant, 47 East 12th Street. It's right below Union Square on the zip code's 1003. And the website is shukonyc.com.
Chef, thanks so much for being here, telling us about your story and your travels and your background in French cuisine and, of course, opening your own restaurant in New York with your partner. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We're taking a little bit of an HRN break, but we'll be back with new episodes soon. I've got plenty of new guests coming at you on the line, and you can, of course, go to heritageradionetwork.org to find all of the 80 episodes of this show and, of course, the other programs that we've got on Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.